what I'm looking at when I think about climate transition. I'm really trying to understand how sectors, how companies will transition, what makes their targets credible, but also ambitious, to really try and understand the winners and losers in that journey to a low carbon sustainable economy. You know, some sectors you could classify as high climate risk. You know, the steel sector, for example, they're responsible for something like, you know, 7 to 9% of greenhouse gas emissions. But steel is actually a material that is so essential for the green energy transition. So I think it's really important to think about it holistically.
Welcome to another episode of the ESG Factor podcast. Today I'm talking to Samuel Grantham, Investment Director in Global Credit at Aberdeen. Samuel, you're a climate transition specialist. Can you explain what climate transition means from an investment perspective?
Yeah, sure. And first of all, thanks for having me. You know, nice to be here. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's good to define some of these terms, given how often we come across them these days. So really, when we think about the threat and the implications of climate change, whether that's, for example, average global temperature rises, changes in weather patterns, loss of ice cover and rising sea levels, it means we need to urgently commit to climate transition. So climate transition is really about that journey to an environmentally sustainable kind of low carbon economy to limit the impacts of climate change. So for example, a climate transition plan could be a company outlining how they will pivot existing assets, you know, operations towards a trajectory that aligns with climate science recommendations. You know, myself as an investor, what I'm looking at when I think about climate transition, I'm really trying to understand how sectors, how companies will transition, what makes their targets credible, but also ambitious, to really try and understand the winners and losers in that journey to a low carbon sustainable economy.
And Samuel, I don't know if you're a football fan, but when you hear football managers, it's a bit off topic, but give me a second. You often hear football managers saying, look, we're going through a transition period. So when I think about climate action and the climate transition, is climate transition just another word for inaction and delay, and that these deadlines are being pushed way out into the future?
Yeah, I'm following you now. I mean, I actually am not a huge football fan, unfortunately. I grew up in Asia. My dad was never a fan, so I didn't watch it much growing up. But, you know, when we think about the transition, and it's a very, you know, fair point to make, you know, we've seen some strong progress in my view, especially over the last few years. You know, things to highlight, you know, though the transition to a low carbon economy clearly will impact different sectors, different regions and different companies as it in different ways, you know, when we think about certain industries like low emission sectors like technology, media, communications, you know, bulk of their emissions are quite easy to reduce. So of course there's been huge progress there. You know, they've shifted to renewables, which drastically has cut their overall emissions for these companies, as long as they have access to that clean energy, of course. When we think about utilities, you know, this is a sector that, again, I think has seen huge progress, and, you know, not necessarily the easiest to transition. You know, they started 10 years ago. They started out building out renewables, spending a huge amount of capex on kind of greener solutions, but also how we transport and distribute that clean energy. So for me, you know, the utilities are really an enabler for the other sectors to decarbonize, as it really provides that clean energy to the wider economy. But as I said, you know, not all companies, not all sectors are kind of, you know, traveling at the same pace. So the oil and gas sector, for example, you know, we think there's not enough action taking place. The targets that we've seen, they're too reliant on new technologies such as, you know, carbon capture and energy storage, and you're not yet scalable. So very early days, you really need to see a shift in gear for some of these companies.
And so if the average company is thinking about a climate action plan and this transition, obviously renewable energy is a big part of that. As you said, it could be an easy win in terms of shifting to renewable energy. But the problem is renewable energy isn't always available to them. So is that the big change that we need to see in terms of the energy sector transforming, so that the proportion of renewable energy is much larger even than has been projected?
I mean, of course, we need to continue developing energy, renewable energy. I mean, you look at the price of solar PV, you know, in 2009 to compared to today, it's something like 90% cheaper. And that's obviously because we've invested a huge amount in kind of renewable technologies, and that's lowered the cost of that technology. But, you know, we need to continue to do more. So, yeah, I would completely agree with you. And it's not, you know, it's not a developed market versus an emerging market thing either. You know, I've looked at, spent a lot of time looking at Chile as a country, and they've been very proactive with climate policy. Yes, they've got, you know, a lot of wind, and obviously they've got a lot of coastal land mass, which means it's great for renewables. But it's definitely, you know, certain regions are lagging, and we think they need to do more.
So it's a big effort in terms of the policy shift at a government level is what you're saying needs to happen.
I think for me, what some of the issues, and this is this, you know, this answers your question. You know, fossil fuel subsidies, for example, are one of the biggest financial barriers, I think, you know, halting the shift into renewable energy sources. You know, each year, governments around the world, you know, pour, you know, $500 trillion essentially into artificially lowering the price of fossil fuels. And that's more than triple what renewables receive. You know, it's not just about the subsidies. It's the cost of emitting greenhouse gas emissions. You know, we think is too low. So, for example, higher carbon prices are another lever which governments and policies could use to support, you know, essentially a cost applied to carbon pollution to encourage polluters to reduce that amount of greenhouse gases they emit into the atmosphere. So, you know, our own economists widely agree that introducing a carbon price would be one of the most effective ways to reduce their emissions at a country level, but also promote renewables. So it's not just, you know, companies, it's also policy in action at the moment, whether that's subsidies for fossil fuels or not enough costs being associated with those high emitters.
So there's a lot of action that needs to be taken to mitigate some of these climate outcomes. But I notice from your own climate scenario analysis, it's predicting that we're on a 2.4 degree warming path. And now there's a lot of talk about climate adaption. So adapting to a warmer climate. Is adaption almost acceptance that we've missed that opportunity to mitigate some of the worst of the outcomes?
I think, you know, even if we were to stop emitting carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels today, it doesn't mean we've solved the climate change crisis. You know, there's a delay in air temperature increases as the atmosphere catches up almost with all the heat that the Earth has accumulated already to this point, you know, from the Industrial Revolution. And it's really that lag between cause and effect, which means essentially, no, you know, we need to continue to try and reduce emissions because we're, you know, we're going to have to adapt to the consequences of a changing climate, not from today's impact, but from 10 years ago. So, you know, there's a huge critical focus now on adaptation. I mean, if you think about tracked climate finance, all of it is on mitigation. But I mean, you see the news every day, you know, more frequent, more material climate related weather events. We really need to shift, but kind of prioritize just as much as mitigation, that focus on adaptation. I think it's hugely important.
And then when it comes to the subject of investments, because climate change obviously is a big issue for everyone outside of investments as well. But from an investment perspective, why is this so important to investors and why do they need to consider it?
Yeah, I mean, climate change will impact everything, right? So in terms of risks and opportunities or kind of tying back to your question on return, you know, if we maybe break it down into different investment products. So when we think about government bonds, you know, traditionally quite a safe investment, you know, the implications there when we think about climate, you know, countries with high exposure to climate related natural disasters, you know, going forward, they will require greater funds to finance that adaptation. And that could result in potential deficits. It could result in migration, health issues for the population. You know, this could lead to potential defaults, you know, rating downgrades, you know, and therefore the price of these bonds could fall as a consequence. However, if the governments and the countries are being proactive in developing, for example, new low carbon industries, you know, building resilience into the economy through water management infrastructure, et cetera, you know, this could actually mean lower cost of financing, lower cost of funding for that country due to the potential lower potential risks. And actually bond prices could benefit from that. You know, Chile has been very proactive in that respect, and it's a region that we like. You know, similar picture for corporate bonds, actually. I mean, you know, the fall in value for issuers that suffer from repeated damage from climate-related weather events. You know, a good example here is Pacific Gas and Electric. That's a Californian-based utility. And probably the first, we don't talk about it, but probably the first climate change bankruptcy in history. And it was really driven by the liabilities they suffered resulting from the wildfires that kind of basically hit California in 2017 and 2018.
Does this kind of play into the importance of governance? If you think about ESG, where obviously we talk a lot about the environment, when we talk about climate change and carbon emissions, but you just mentioned a bankruptcy off the back of that. Does that kind of say that, look, governance needs to do more to make sure that some of this stuff is measured so that this exposure isn't actually there for investors if you're talking about an investment fund or a particular company?
Yeah, I mean, governance is hugely important. I mean, in general, just improved transparency, I'd say, is fundamental. I mean, when we were looking at Pacific Gas and Electric 10, 15 years ago, you would have never, you know, been concerned about climate-related risks. But now what you're seeing is a real shift a change in the industry. Investors are demanding more action and more kind of transparency and more data around climate, but just not just climate. Clearly, you know, there's other things that we're concerned about, whether it's biodiversity impact, where it's social impact, monoculture impact. There's huge impacts on the ecosystem, the climate, but also the societal impacts as well. So yeah, I think this is a great wake up for certain industries and certain sectors, especially, you know, oil and gas and high climate risk sectors. But things need to get better, absolutely.
And if you look at TCFD, then the way that they talk about climate change, and it's a big focus on the financial impact of climate change, and definitely from an investment perspective, it's still framed in that dynamic of risk and return. Is that what will bring the change that we need? In other words, like we've known about climate change for decades. There's been, you know, the likes of Carl Sagan warning decades ago, others have done the same. But now investors are starting to realize that it might actually hurt the bottom line. Is that the real motivation? And is it a kind of also in some way the sad reality of the situation that we're in, that people have not been motivated by the need to protect our planet, the need to help developing countries, the need to help communities and societies, that it's really been driven by financial motives?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, you know, you've touched on a few points there. I mean, one is, you know, mitigation has been the core focus of climate transition finance to date. And you know, take a step back, why is that? And when you think about adaptation, it's predominantly for municipals, it's predominantly for sovereigns to finance within their own economy. And actually, maybe returns aren't as high. You know, when you think about a sovereign bond return versus a corporate bond. So I think, you know, there are some underlying truths within that statement. I mean, the just transition is a great concept. And obviously, that's all about ensuring that certain regions of the economy of the globe are supported when you think about transitioning their economies to a low carbon economy, because it is crucially important. I mean, when you think about the physical risks of climate change, it's going to impact kind of the developing world, you know, three times more than the developed. So it is alarming, and I think, you know, There is a wake-up situation at the moment, and actually, you know, there was a lot of focus on this at COP as well. But yeah, I think I don't have an answer for you. I think I definitely agree with you, but not in every respect. I think, God, it's a tricky one. Yeah,
it's a tricky one. I think it gets there's a philosophical element to it, I suppose, in terms of the concept of sustainable economic development and what kind of society we want to create. Because when we're still anchored to these metrics of risk and return, concerned about the financial impact of climate change rather than, let's say, the physical impact and how it's going to, as you said, cause mass migration and lead to some serious challenges for particularly the developing world, as you said. And I think it probably goes beyond the remit that you have as an investment director in terms of meeting the objectives of investors, but it's definitely something that policymakers, we've seen the sustainable development goals, we're way behind on that. But I would say more needs to be done at a policy level to try and tackle some of those underlying challenges.
I completely agree. And actually, you know, there are beacons of hope. I mean, when I look at a company report, financial statement these days, and I look at their sustainability report, I mean, if you told me 5 years ago that companies would be making targets 30 years out, and not just around emissions or, you know, around the use of waste, the use of water management, the impact on the biodiversity in their operations, I would have said, you know, that's just not going to happen. But, you know, this is starting to happen. And it's not even remuneration linked to the executive team. It's linked to the entire workforce. And obviously, these are rare cases, but that will grow and that will change. So I am hopeful.
And where, as an investor, you see companies that are having an outsized impact in terms of contributing to climate change, would you be in favor of avoiding securities of these companies through divestment or exclusions? Or do you believe in the idea of engaging with companies to move them along this transition?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's something we debate about a lot. I mean, it really depends what you mean by contributing to climate change. For example, you know, some sectors at the moment, they have high emissions, you know, which we could classify as high climate risk. You know, the steel sector, for example, they're responsible for something like, you know, 7 to 9% of greenhouse gas emissions. But steel is actually a material that is so essential for the green energy transition. It's crucial for electrification. But when you think about renewables, and I've got, you know, I think it's something like 1 megawatt of solar requires 35 to 45 tons of steel. 1 megawatt of wind power requires 120 tons of steel. So I think it's really important to think about it holistically. You know, I'm happy as an investor to own a company with high emissions today, potentially perceived as high climate risk, if I think they're on that credible trajectory in terms of reducing emissions, making business practices more sustainable in line with a net zero future. So really, for me, it's essential that they have a track record, they have reduction targets, they're ambitious, and importantly, they're enabling the wider economy to decarbonize. A bit like the example before on utilities, you know, providing that clean energy, you know, the steel company provides that raw material to then go out and produce wind turbines. And actually, you know, you do see a lot of, you know, you see a lot of low carbon investment products out there, which you could say are low climate risk. But I think personally, it's slightly short-sighted. You know, you're looking at, you know, investment strategies which are just geared to banks and technology companies. You could argue how effective is that to drive, you know, real world emission reductions. But anyway, back to your point, sorry, I'm going off topic slightly, but, you know, clearly we think there are some sectors that are at risk and they will require a huge amount of engagement. You know, the energy companies I bring up again, you know, I think a lot of the time at the moment, those targets in place are not credible. They're not ambitious enough. And so for some of our funds, you know, that has led to divestment. Engagement is crucial. It's the climate transition is a journey. It's not a binary decision whether you're, you know, net zero or you're low carbon. It really is going to be a journey. And so engagement is crucial for that journey.
And have you seen examples where engagement has actually worked and you've had meaningful discussions with some of these companies and they've grasped the gravity of the situation and that they're willing to actually come to the table with credible solutions, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, I've got more examples where it's led to divestment and it's been an outcome which is probably not positive. But you know, cement as a sector is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and at the moment it's a very hard to abate sector. You know, it's very difficult to understand how they approach net zero by 2050. And actually, a lot of the sustainable reports that we've seen in terms of understanding breaking down their transition policies relies on offsets. So in our view, a lot of offsets aren't sustainable. So we engaged with one company which we thought was leading kind of the space. And basically we flagged the fact that we thought, you know, the industry relying on offsets was not sustainable. And so they took that into their action plan and they talked about trying to not rely on offsets. And also one of the challenges we had with the sector was we didn't understand how they got from today to net zero by 2050. And so this company came out with a net zero plant by 2030. So one of their plants they're building at the moment will be net zero and by 2030. And so that's great for us because that means we can check the progress and we can check and sense check the technology as well. So, you know, essentially in a few years time, we might be seeing one of the first cement companies with an asset, which is completely net zero. So that's really promising.
So it does work if you've got the right people in charge.
Yes.
And so for investors that are actually more climate conscious, let's say, what types of solutions are available for investors or even advisors and trustees who are trying to incorporate this into an investment strategy?
I mean, I'd argue that all investors should be incorporating into their investment strategy because it impacts every sector and every region. But obviously, you can have a more kind of thematic focused climate product, I guess. There are types of instruments. I mean, I'm obviously a corporate portfolio manager, so you know, I tend to focus on the corporates and the sovereign bonds. But from a corporate space, we've seen a huge development in green bond financing. So this is essentially bond instruments that are linked to certain environmentally positive outcomes. So it could be developing renewable energy for a certain plant, for a utility, for example, for an energy company, or it could be, for example, building green buildings for a real estate company. So that's one way to get exposure, I guess. I mean, in our view, green bonds aren't the total solution just because they tend to be skewed to certain sectors, certain regions of the economy. For example, you don't see a huge amount of green bond issuance from emerging markets. It's very developed market, European focused. I guess the other thing to think about is, you know, there are certain low carbon products, but again, you know, just tilting away from these high emission sectors, I think is a bit short-sighted, or we think is a bit short-sighted. It doesn't necessarily translate into how these companies will perform longer term. You know, I talk about SSE because this was a company with a very high carbon footprint 10 years ago, but today, you know, they're incredibly well placed with respect to the transition. So I don't have like the perfect solution for you. You know, it is a mixed bag. I think there are certain strategies incorporating climate from a risk and opportunities perspective, which are powerful. But really, you need to be engaging with these companies, doing a huge amount of active research. You can't just rely on, for example, a net zero by 2050 target, because actually, guess what? A lot of these companies don't actually have any credible plans of getting there. They've just set a target and they've got no plans in place. So I'd say do a lot of research.
You've written on the importance of research when it comes to green bonds, that some people look at the label and behind that label, the bonds aren't always as green as one might expect. Is this the biggest challenge for the average investor who's trying to understand where to put the money?
Yeah, this is something we really struggle with, just because, you know, a lot of the time it's assumed that when an issuer comes to the market with a green bond, that those proceeds are used for something sustainable. And actually, if a company has a green bond, it doesn't mean they necessarily even disclose emissions. It doesn't even mean they necessarily have emission reduction targets. So what we do is we take a step back. We look at the issuer. We say, ignore the green bond for now. Let's look at the issuer. Let's understand their policies, understand, you know, how remuneration is linked in terms of climate policies and climate transition plans. And then we look at the specific financing and the specific use of proceeds. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we've seen issuers before where, you know, it's a real estate company, for example, and they're refinancing buildings they built 10 years ago. And they're not actually doing anything with the use of proceeds. They're just refinancing an existing building. So refinancing existing debt. So actually, from a positive environmental impact assessment, nothing happens. So that's why you really have to look at the issuer. You have to look at the specific framework, the financing framework, to really understand what's actually taking place.
Yeah, it just seems like no matter what we talk about in terms of the broader climate transition, authenticity is a big factor here. And we need companies, we need politicians, we need individuals to be more authentic when it comes to the claims being made around their commitments to the climate transition. And their wider corporate social responsibilities, because I think that issue of greenwashing is probably one of the biggest challenges that we do face.
I completely agree.
And if you think about our discussion today, I mean, the biggest takeaway I have is that all companies, all stakeholders have to think about the long term, have a credible plan in place. It requires obviously long-term thinking and planning. But at the same time, we live in a world where attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. You know, in the investment world, we're still playing this game of quarterly expectations. Politicians have their eyes on the next election. There's a real challenge at a system level to make this transition happen, given that we're still anchored to such short-term thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I seem to be agreeing a lot with you. But I think the system is too short-term focused. I mean, you know, you think the landscape is shifting, and I mean, I touched on this already, but, you know, there are promising kind of beacons of hope. I mean, 10 years ago, if you told me again, a company's management would need to have corporate targets, not for next quarter or next year, but 30 years out, you would have laughed. But essentially, that's what's happened. You know, when you think about emission targets, and it's not just emissions, as I've highlighted, you know, it's about that impact on the economy, the reduction of waste, the water consumption, biodiversity targets. not just in 30 years, but investors are demanding more detail and more impact now. You know, these targets are also, as I said, you know, they're tied to remuneration. And not just at the executive level, but you're starting to see that implemented more broadly across the entire workforce. And we think this trend will continue. But you're right, you know, we are too focused on the short term. But things are changing. I mean, you talk about the politicians, you know, having their eyes on the next election, and that's very amusing because you think about, you know, the Australian elections, which happened very recently. You know, climate policy essentially emerged as the big winner of the election. You know, following 2 years essentially of disastrous bushfires, flooding, you know, the local party defending the use of coal, the public have said enough's enough. You know, with the ruling Liberal National Coalition basically losing the federal election to the Australian Labor Party. And this is, you know, a party who have advocated for a much stronger climate policy and net zero transition. So I think it'll be very interesting how this election reshapes Australian climate policy and energy transition outlook going forward. But it's also a wake up for other economies across the globe. But yeah, I mean, I do agree. The short-term focus is a huge hindrance to kind of broader development and a sustainable economy going forward.
That's a good point, Samuel. And I think we'll end on that note. I think the big message is that for people to be more informed, you need to have greater transparency. We need credible investment managers providing the information that investors and advisors and other capital allocators need. We need politicians to show real character and to talk to voters in a way that they can actually understand what these politicians are setting out over the next number of years to deal with the climate transition. And that's what we're trying to do with the podcast. So thanks very much for coming on the podcast today, Samuel.
Thanks very much, Vincent.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the ESG Factor podcast. If you'd like to share any thoughts or feedback on today's episode, then you can email me at vincent@theesgfactor.com. Also, if you'd like to see the making of more independent content like this, you can join our Patreon community online. Just visit theesgfactor.com.